This is Distraction Therapy, a podcast from Rob Watson. Conversations about how we're coping at a time of change. Hello, it's Friday the 5th of February, and this is a Distraction Therapy podcast with me, Rob Watson. And today I'm joined over the internet by Jonathan Taylor. And Jonathan is I wouldn't describe you as a polymath, because there's not much maths involved, but you're an author, a lecturer, an editor, and a critic, and a poet. How are you doing?
I'm okay, yeah. Actually, there is a bit of maths these days because of homeschooling.
Of course, yeah. It's a bit of everything, isn't there? So yeah. What age is it that you're homeschooling for?
Well, our twins are 12. So I was terrible at maths at school, so I'm learning with them, really. I'm probably about 1 inch ahead of them on every task.
And what have you relearned that you kind of, is this a complete shock? You kind of going, oh, hang on a minute, I never understood that when I was at school, but now it makes perfect sense.
Well, it's funny you should say that, actually, because in many ways, like I say, I mean, I was always someone who was good at English, and you, it's a kind of cliche, isn't it, that most people are either good at one, either English or maths, but very rarely both. But actually, I've learned how to do long multiplication after 30 years, more than 30 years, 40 years of not being able to do it. So, you know, I don't know what good it'll do me in my job, but it's nice to know.
Yeah, it's this is really the topic of the podcast in a way, is what are the things that we've found or, you know, kind of renewed or kind of, you know, kind of taken from the hidden depths, if you like, in terms of how we're getting through the lockdown. So paint us a picture of, because you've been working, you know, people have this idea that the universities are shut, they're not. What's over the last kind of 9-10 months, what's life been like? Is it, you know, the ups and downs? Has it been busier? Has it been quieter? What's the general picture?
Busier. It's been absolutely crazy. I mean, on the one hand, you're dealing with what everyone is dealing with, which is a pandemic. On the other hand, homeschooling. On the other hand, work. Teaching online, preparation, everything has to be done from scratch at university, because clearly you're dealing with such a different sort of situation. And then just trying round the edges of things to live and to do a bit of my own writing, which is clearly like very important to me. So it's a kind of polyphonic existence, really, where every hour I'm sort of often doing two or three things at the same time. And I know that's the same for so many people as well.
There's the kind of media cliche, isn't there, of people baking and yoga and reading through the works of Charles Dickens and things like that. You've not had the time to do anything. You've not mapped anything out for yourself.
Not really. I mean, in the first lockdown, there were moments of calm, simply because no one knew what they were doing, and the homeschooling at that point was kind of much more sort of patchy in many ways. At that point, the academic term, I mean, you know, I teach 12 months a year because I teach a lot of postgraduates as well, but you know, the actual kind of undergraduate teaching was kind of gradually coming to an end. So there was a bit more kind of space in that sort of first, you know, April, May time, in which, yes, you know, we did have time to go for walks, and everyone knows what a beautiful spring it was, you know, that you wanted to kind of, you know, for all of that, obviously all of the horror that was going on in the corner of our eyes, you know, the it was a beautiful spring and we were going out sort of enjoying the blossoms and the sunshine. So that was different. I think it's changed, you know, and a lot of people have said this to me from different backgrounds, that the second and third lockdowns were very different, and that by autumn it felt much sort of harder, shall we say.
Yeah. It's a bit kind of closing in, isn't it? You kind of that idea of kind of measuring time becomes, for a lot of people, it's become quite kind of, you've got no sense of how things are unfolding because you're not, you know, especially at winter, it's harder because, but I realise I'm measuring time by how often I put the bins out. You know, it's once a week the bins go out and get collected. And for me, I realised this morning when I heard the bin lorry go past a few minutes ago that, oh, that's how I'm pacing myself at the moment. So what are the things? Are you like a binge watcher of anything? Because what have you done to kind of fill in those gaps of, you know, you're a prolific reader, or have you kind of?
Actually, I have gone back to reading. I mean, you know, it sounds bizarre as someone who teaches English and creative writing, but there were a few years, especially when the twins were very young, where, of course, I read, but I was reading much less. But I've gone, you know, the last couple of years, I've gone back to reading huge amounts. And in fact, I was always a painfully slow reader in the past. It would take me months sometimes to read a Victorian novel. I'm much quicker now. I don't know why that is, you know. Maybe you kind of, when you get to middle age, you feel like time's running out, so you've got to speed up. I have been reading a lot. You know, we don't have sort of things like Netflix, but we watch kind of old films and things like that as well. So, you know, round the edges of existence, it's kind of, it's got more and more squeezed as the pandemic's gone on. But kind of those kind of odd hours you have where you can kind of do something else. Yeah, you know, it's that those moments have been lovely. And of course, like, you know, the other thing that does make a slight difference is that I'm not commuting. And I mean, I only commute sort of 10 miles down the road, but it takes me an hour and a half. So actually having that extra hour does give you a bit of space and time to do things like reading and watching films and also just that bit of writing that's important.
Yeah, you squeeze in the pace of the day is different. I tend to get up kind of 7 o'clock and have an hour of just kind of, you know, flicking through the news and then start work on emails and things. And my problem is I kind of tend to overfill and add a few extra things in there. But in the evenings, it's really been a case of there's not that much. There's a few things I watch on Netflix and Amazon Prime and stuff, but there's not that much. And I'm happier sitting with a pair of headphones in, listening to some music and reading. I'm doing, as you say, I'm really slow at reading as well. But it's like I've got through, you know, a couple of dozen books now in the last few months, which I thought, you know, why did I stop doing this? Because all the meetings and the action takes over, doesn't it? You know, let's be busy, let's keep ourselves going, and the moments of contemplation are kind of, they're fewer and far, you know, farther between.
I think that's absolutely right, and I think that the two things that there are that does make a slight difference to my day is I don't miss the commuting, you know, I don't miss that drive at all. And also, that there are just slightly fewer meetings and you're not kind of going between them, you know, you're not sort of, you know, so you just kind of go online and you know, so many meetings, if it's a lot of people there, you can do something else at the same time. And in a way, that's kind of what I'm saying about this kind of weirdly, especially during the day, as you say, slightly less in the evenings, but during the day, this kind of polyphonic existence where you're constantly doing two or three things at the same time. And that has both big disadvantages, but also, you know, some little advantages as well. But things like the commuting, I mean, who misses that? I mean, who wants to do that, really?
No, you're right. I think it's kind of, I mean, there are some moments, I suppose it depends how you do it and where you do it and how much you're getting paid for it. But yeah, I think it's gone, hasn't it, really? The kind of focus on that is maybe not every day, you know, maybe people might go into the office in a, you know, once a week or something, rather than, but then you miss out on the joy of the, you know, in-person experience when that returns, if it was ever a joy.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, that is the big loss, really, is that actually, you know, and I know not all academics would agree with me on this, but I love the teaching, you know. I mean, of course, like, you know, you don't want to do it all the time and it takes over your life, but actually, you know, meeting students and talking to students about their writing and stuff like that, it's real. It's kind of, and life seems so unreal at the moment. I'm just talking to kind of, often doing lessons where I'm just talking to kind of icons on screens, if people have switched their cameras off, you're just talking to kind of a silhouette. And so I really miss that kind of actual meeting students and talking to students about their writing in person. And, you know, it's, I think that is a big loss. Nothing online can ever replace that.
You know, and how have your students been adapting to this? Is it, I mean, because I always think, you know, this glass half full, half empty kind of approach, isn't it? You know, there's a lot of people saying, oh, this is terrible. It's a generation that's going to be lost. And actually, what you're not doing is celebrating their creativity and ingenuity to do things in a different way. What you're doing is you're putting your anxieties on them to say, oh, well, like, you know, we need to overcompensate, if you like, for this deficiency. And actually, there's a lot of things, if you're tuned into how and what they're doing things, that you realise, what's it been like for you in that sense? What have your students responded to this madness by?
Well, it's funny you should say that, because there was that report, wasn't there, a few days ago from some think tank saying that, oh, kids growing up now, school kids will lose something like, I don't know what it was, 40,000, 50,000 pound earning power over their lifetimes or something like that. And it's like talk about putting kind of kids down, you know, and sort of there's something really kind of negative about that. And also, like, it's just, we live in this world where, like, well, like, everything is kind of just reduced to economics, and it's not money, you know, it's not about money. I think there are differences, and that clearly, like, our 12-year-old twins, you know, they're not yet at the age where that kind of independent learning is, it is difficult for them, you know. Of course it's difficult for them. They want to go on Roblox. They don't want to sort of sit down and independently learn about trigonometry. So I think there's a difference between that and, you know, teaching at universities. The students are so independent anyway. And yeah, I mean, you know, the first term of lockdown, it was a shock to everyone, and there were all sorts of kind of issues thrown up by that, and you know, some students cope with it better than others.
And millions of parents finally getting a sense of what it is that teachers actually do all day.
Yeah. And so it was, but actually the students have adjusted amazingly well, absolutely amazingly well. They've adjusted better than, like, you know, kind of, us, you know. It's been really quite challenging, I think.
A friend of mine told me about his son, and he said he was really worried because during the first lockdown, the homeschooling was, he said it was pretty much a disaster. They'd written it off. They could get their son to sit down for maybe an hour a day, and then he was out playing football and, you know, completely active. When they went back into school, they got kind of, you know, they had a parent's consultation, and he'd improved dramatically because he'd had the freedom, and his reading had improved, and his, you know, his cognitive abilities, because we've got this kind of dominant model, haven't we, of learning that has to be sitting down at the desk. As you say, you know, it's measured by your earning potential, not by what you've understood and what you've learned. And what you've grasped.
And it's also like this model that people have of education that is like kind of filling a beaker with water, that oh no, they've missed this information, they've missed this information. And it's like, actually, education isn't about filling people with information or knowledge. It's not about, oh God, they haven't yet learned about 1066. It's about... education, something different to that. It's a much more kind of, and I don't want to sound mystical, but it's a much more complex thing than what have you missed? What bits have you missed? It's about
exploring. It's about connect. Yeah, it's about making connections. It's about problem solving. It's about telling stories. It's on so many different ways that a kind of transactional view of learning, just cram yourself with facts.
Well, in a robot, it's like a kind of computer program, isn't it? We're going to fill this robot with that analogy
of our consciousness, where people say it's a bit like an operating system and we need to reboot it. That annoys me. No, it's not. It's nothing like that at all. Have you changed anything with your own writing practice? Is there any kind of impact on how you're going about doing, you know, your work because of the change in the technology and all that kind of stuff?
I had two or three years before the pandemic where I wasn't writing as much, and well before I'd heard of coronavirus, two or three years of just manic kind of drowning and overwhelming kind of day-to-day 9 to 5, well, more than 9 to 5 university work. And there were various reasons for that, which I don't need to go into, to do with understaffing. But I'd been writing a bit, but I hadn't been writing much. But the one thing that lockdown did do was just kind of galvanize me, really, into thinking, I want to do some proper writing. I want to write something new and, you know, start from scratch. And so even if it was just in last year, I mean, much less so since October, but for the first sort of 7 or 8 months, even if it was just 1 hour a day, you know, in my little kind of shed, I was having 1 hour of writing time. And I written a draft of a book, so it was lovely, you know, and it was like it had all been kind of pent up, and because of the kind of and partly I think because of the sort of feeling that I needed just one little space a day away from the news, away from any thought of, you know, it gave me that sort of little escape hatch where I could switch everything else off just for one day and write like that. And it was immensely kind of psychologically valuable, I think.
I was going to ask you about your kind of process is, I know it's probably a question you get asked, you know, on a regular basis, and certainly it's stuff that you must teach, but, you know, I'm the kind of writer, if I sit and look at a blank page, actually I can't do stuff spontaneously. I have to kind of construct a load of things, scaffold it, if you like, with lots of information, and then it gets rewritten and rewritten and rewritten, and it kind of builds up, then it accumulates. It's like where things get, it's like an accretion process where you gather things together. Can you sit at that page and things come forward?
I can now, yes. I've been doing it for so long that it's like that you practice so much over the years that you just get into that kind of rhythm where I can sit and just write something. I know, and I've trained myself in that way in the early years, you know, sort of 35 years ago, I would have very much just sort of sat there sort of frozen by what people call writer's block and so on and so forth. But it's just sort of training. It's just sort of practice, like practicing the piano. You gradually kind of build up. And also, I think I've always had a full-time job or been doing something else alongside it. If I've wanted to write, I've had to kind of make myself. I've had to kind of, there is a kind of compulsion there. And so, I'll give you one example, which is that when the twins were tiny, I mean, I would have, 1 hour a week to where we got a bit of help and I could do 1 hour a week of writing. And if I didn't write in that 1 hour, then I wouldn't write at all, you know. So through absolute compulsion and force of circumstance, if I wanted to do some writing, I had to do it then. So I've kind of, in that way, I've sort of trained myself. And it doesn't matter, sometimes, much of the time, it's rubbish, you know, what I'm writing, but at least I'm getting something down. So in some ways, it's not dissimilar to the description you gave of your practice, you know, but it's an accretion, and that there's plenty of rubbish that gets written, but it gradually coalesces into something.
I like the bits that I write that are rubbish. They're the ones I tend to share. It's like the stuff that goes out, you know. I find it they're the easiest ones to let go of and put it out in the world. The ones that I kind of labour over are the ones that I've never really seen the light of day. So what kind of, I suppose relationship maybe is the right word in terms of your, so I was looking through your blog, which has got, you know, a good selection of your and description. It's the jonathantaylor.co.uk. Get that plug in, and I'll put a link onto the post as well. But you write poetry and you write fiction, and you also publish academically as well. Is that something? I was reading a biography of W.B. Yeats, and it was fascinating that what I didn't understand about Yeats was his interest in mysticism and the occult, or whatever it was described of it. That, you know, it was fairly popular at that time, which drew a lot of his images brought forward. And then I kind of looked at it in the context of my own work, which I'm fairly concrete and facts-based rather than mythopoetic, if you put it in that kind of way. How would you describe your... Here we go. This is a really difficult question for you to answer, but you might go with it if you can. How would you describe your poetry?
I love Yeats, actually. And and like you, I'm kind of in part a sort of knee-jerk kind of rationalist, but like most rationalists, I'm also absolutely fascinated with the opposite. So I've always been fascinated by Yeats's of a life as an occultist. And and as you say, there was a kind of there's a lot of it about in the early 20th century with writers and artists. How would I describe my poetry? I mean, in a general sense, it's always hard, isn't it? Like if you asked as a writer, what is your voice? You know, how do you pinpoint your voice? And people often talk about writers finding their voice as if it's a kind of grand mystical thing. And I sort of think that I often say to students, I'm not sure I believe in writers finding their voice. I believe in writers finding voices, plural, because actually what I did was I learned to listen to how other people speak around me. And maybe that's why my first creative book was a memoir, because actually I could hear, you know, my family's voices all around me, and put that into kind of dialogue and so on and so forth. So I think in many ways that your voice writer is a kind of composite of all of the voices that you grow up with and that are around you. And so I suppose, if I was to kind of say what I write about, I people have said that there's a lot of dark humor in what I write. I tend to, even when I think I'm writing seriously, other people think it's funny, which may or may not be a good thing. And I tend to write about certain particular subjects. I'm one of those writers who write about home a lot. There are the writers who endlessly write about places they go to and places they visit and places they get to know. And then there are writers like Alan Bennett, etc., who write endlessly about places that they grew up in, places they know. And I think I'm in the latter camp, really. With the poetry, funny you should mention Yeats early, which is that my last book of poems was actually about, in part, kind of occultist kinds of prophecy and other kinds of prophecy as well, actually scientific forms of prophecy and prediction. So in many ways, again, you know, but I sort of I think of myself as a sort of rationalist, and yet I'm endlessly writing about things that don't quite fit into that scheme, because I don't think in the end, I think our reality isn't just, there are mystical elements to it, there are weird elements to it that we don't understand.
I read what did I read, let me get it, I've got Heisenberg. I was reading a book of his, Physics and Philosophy, I think it is. I kind of got into this through reading Carl Jung, and Carl Jung was aligned with he was a Wolfgang Pauli, the Nobel laureate physicist, and he had a lot of conversations and correspondence with him about the nature of quantum physics and kind of atomic physics. And there's it's fascinating because there's a kind of an analogy there about meaning, which is that when you look at things down at that quantum level, I'm trying to explain something I don't fully understand, that the shift in relationships change. So what we think of as matter is not matter. What we think of as time is not time. And I have this struggle of thinking, Heisenberg says is that, you know, the relationship between facts, you know, if you like, scientific, empirical facts and evidence and meaning is still not understood. You know, we still have that kind of the two are distinct, and we need both in order to, you know, it's almost that kind of yin and yang type thing, isn't it? You know, you kind of need to be able to, but we're locked. One of the things that Jung talks about is that we're kind of locked in a world of in the West, in, you know, European culture, your modernist or postmodernist culture is now locked in the empirical. It's fact based. It's rationalist, and we've kind of moved away from the numinous, or the, you know, the primitive experience of things having a spirit in their own right. And yeah. I kind of, the crossover for that, it's pointing me more in the direction of reading things that I'm not a great fiction reader. I kind of read, you know, J.G. Ballard and Philip K. Dick and things like that, but they're not really focused on maybe Dick is, but on a transcendent experience of meaning. They're not poetic in that sense, and it's that was one of the things I've kind of picked up through the lockdown, really, is that a shift in saying, well, yeah, okay, there's so much information, so much news and things happening out there in the world. I need something which points me in a bit of a different direction. And it feels like early days with this at this point. I'm certainly not in any kind of credible position, but it does. I have this reluctance to talk about it because it sounds like mysticism and religion. And I kind of go, oh, well, I don't know what this is about. You know, I haven't had the experience of talking about this.
And like there's all sorts of people, like I'm a big fan of Oliver Sacks, you know, and the neurologist, and Sacks, you know, he's a neurologist, and neuroscience is a kind of in many ways a materialistic science, and yet what he says is that you know, materialism at the level of neurons, like at the level of quantum, so at the level of neurons, it becomes almost a kind of transcendent or sort of spiritual experience, because there is that part of human experience. You can't wipe out that part of human experience. I mean, I one of my academic books, I wrote about sort of the way in which science writing often taps into metaphorically and sometimes narratively into very, very old mystical discourses. So, you know, cosmology on the one hand and quantum physics on the other hand actually use the terms and the metaphors and the language of, you know, Pythagoras and the music of the spheres and a kind of hermetic tradition. And it, you know, it's fascinating the way in which I don't mean, and funnily enough, this goes back to this idea of knowledge being something that you kind of fill a beaker with, that knowledge is not accumulative, that it just changes, it just morphs, and that the terms that Oliver Sacks or Heisenberg use actually does have a prehistory, you know, 2,500 years back in Lucretius or Pythagoras or closer than that, sort of people from the Renaissance. So it's, I feel that you're absolutely right, you know, that rationalism is so dominant in the West, but maybe what literature can do is it can use that as a basis, but it can also explore other forms of experience which are real to people that, you know, I have to admit I'm no Christian, but I was brought up one, but you can't ignore the fact that for whether or not you yourself believe it, that there are a lot of people, millions of people in Britain for whom that is real, and it's real for them, it's true for them. So a writer can kind of deal with these things that or subjective truths, if you like.
There's a word that I'm trying to remember the name of, and it's that idea of contradictions, that which is like a kind of this begins with an A. I'll try and dig it out on Wikipedia or something. I had a brain freeze just when I need the word. It always happens with me. But it's that idea, and I'm just looking at the description from your book about laughter and literature and violence, and the idea that you've got this kind of two opposite functions, if you like. Laughter as an emotional release and violence, what did you learn in writing and researching that book about those kind of how those opposites interact with each other?
And it kind of goes back to what you're saying, that I write in lots of different sort of forms, and I always thought that they were kind of separate, really, you know. So I always thought like the academic writing was separate to the creative writing. But at some kind of unconscious level, in a way, you're always writing the same book, just in different forms, you know, that actually there are connections. So what I said a few minutes ago about sort of that people say there's a lot of dark humour and grotesque humour in what I write relates very much. You know, I was writing that book and then it suddenly struck me, oh, gosh, this is actually a kind of critical version of what I've been doing creatively, which is exploring sort of, you know, the darker kinds of humour. There is a very, what I discovered in writing it, you know, and I'm one of those writers who writes books to find things out, you know, to explore things, to kind of, I've got this image, I don't know what it means, I'm going to go with it and sort of find out what it means. And the image that started it off was very much kind of, I suppose, early 20th century and particularly First World War humour, which, you know, the humour in the trenches was often about death and about violence and mutilation and so on and so forth. And those really, really dark moments of laughter and humour, I think are fascinating. They kind of, and also they sort of expose something that kind of that's often unconscious and lies, but also is the secret of a lot of humour, especially, I mean, I don't want to make generalizations, but especially I think British humour, that a lot of the most well-known British sitcoms, for example, are actually very dark. Steptoe and Son, Fawlty Towers, these are things about people who are desperate, who are powerless, Basil Fawlty just having a nervous breakdown every single episode. Steptoe and Son, in a way, shouldn't be funny at all. Its darkest episodes are just power struggles, tragedies, really. But I'm kind of fascinated in a way that actually I think these things aren't opposites, that they're incredibly closely related.
I was just looking through. I've got some notes. That one of the things I've started doing is taking a lot of notes as I'm reading, which is good. And Jung, in his book Two Essays, says life is born of the spark of opposites, and it's kind of the regulation between that. And I wonder if, you know, you and I share an experience of teaching at universities, and we've kind of shifted towards a model of education which is only balanced on one side and doesn't present people with the opposing process of opposites. It's purely, you know, as you said earlier, you know, it's about this is going to get you a job and this is the benefit you'll get in an economic sense. But what it doesn't present anybody with is the hard work of saying, actually, you can twist and change the meaning of this word around because it comes from different traditions. And when you, that's the fascinating thing I find about, and the really annoying thing as well, when you read something and you see a word and you go, oh, what does that mean? And you discover that there's a whole tradition of literature that you knew nothing about. And you've got, in order to justify the point you're making in an article or something that you're writing, you've then got to spend 3 months learning what that word actually means and how it's used. And it opens you up to a wider sense of comprehension. But just having this functional sense of meaning isn't sufficient. It doesn't explain the challenges and the slippages, does it?
And I think the education has become so instrumentalist, so kind of reductionist, everything becomes about, to use a horrible word, employability becomes about where will this lead you? And I always say to anyone who's thinking of doing a degree at university, for God's sake, it's 3 years of your life. They're three years that are just as real as the 3 years after that, or the 3 years after that, and you want to do something that you actually get by doing it, not by what comes after. But there is a sort of we've forgotten. There've been sort of times where I've been kind of almost like looked at as some kind of weird sort of out there radical hippie, which I do have that side. But when I've said, but what about education for education's sake? I actually. And in a way, again, this goes back to, this idea that actually I enjoy, when I'm writing a book, for example, just exploring things, learning about stuff. I want to learn about stuff. It's, a lot of what I learn might not go anywhere. It's not going to make anyone much money, let alone me. But I want to find things out. And I really believe that... learning is a kind of creative thing in itself, and we kind of if we ignore that side of education, what we end up with, that kind of creative creative imaginative self-development model of education, what we end up with, I think, which is terrible, is just massive mental illness, and I think it's dangerous, actually. I don't think this is a minor thing. I think this is kind of a real imperative that we need to refine. We need to refine that sort of
kind of liberal education. Yeah,
absolutely.
So what things have you been, drawing on that have been you found most satisfying? And what reading have you, has sparked your imagination and given you, nourishment?
There's loads of things. I am a bit like Yeats, actually. I'm an eclectic reader. I will read anything, and no one believes me when I say this, but there aren't many books that I read that I don't enjoy in some way. And so I'll read anything from kind of philosophy to academic stuff, to novels, to plays, to poetry, and I'm a bit of a kind of magpie, I think, and no doubt that reflects in what I write as well, that I wrote two novels, so now I want to do something else. I wrote poetry. Now I want to write something kind of academic or a memoir or whatever. And I sort of, I do have kind of a big attention span when I'm doing something, but then I want to do something new, and it has kind of, it does have costs. It means that I enjoy myself and I enjoy whatever I'm doing, but it means that, You never very well, if all I'd ever written was novels, maybe I'd have been better known as a novelist. It means that you're moderately you're moderately known as I mean, not that I care about that anyway, but you're moderately known as one thing, and then you go and do something else, and then you do, you know. So it means that I've got a very kind of disparate writer's CV, shall we say.
But so there isn't a Tolkien-esque, you know, netherworld hidden in a manuscript in a drawer somewhere.
No, I just honestly, I do just. I don't see the point of doing what the kind of things that we do, you know, being creative. I don't see the point of it if you're not just enjoying it for its own sake. So I write whatever I feel like, and then people can deal with it or not. You know, I've got this feeling that because I enjoy it so much, and because it's a kind of compulsion, that I would probably write even if it never got published. Which is not to say I do it for myself, because I want readers, you know, I want people. I don't believe it when writers say, oh, I just write for myself. I don't think that's true, but at the same time, I enjoy it, you know, I find it pleasurable. And maybe a lot of people talk about writing and creativity in, you know, as a kind of painful, so painful, you know. There's that phrase where people say, oh, I'm bleeding on the page, you know, it's so difficult. And it's like, no, it's not. It's fun. I enjoy it. I love doing it. It's pleasure. It's not doing my twins' maths homework. It's not cleaning the dishes. It's not attending meetings or filling in forms for work. It's fun, it's pleasurable, it's enjoyable.
And what have you learned from your twins reading? Because the last I saw, I think it was either on Twitter or Instagram, where it's a Japanese anime types. what's it called? The cartoon type stuff. My brain's gone. I've only had two coffees this morning.
Yeah, no, it's manga.
Manga, that's the word I was looking for, yes. What have you learned from that?
How violent a lot of it is. And again, sometimes it does mix kind of violence with humour. It's amazing stuff. And you know, again, this is what I want to do. I want to learn about new stuff all the time. And so, you know, the twins getting into manga and anime is fascinating. Some of it, you know, like any form, some of it's better than others. Some of it really is just slasher. And some of it comes close to pornography. It's a different literary tradition. It's fascinating. Graphic novels are something that, in a wider sense, are something that I didn't know much about, didn't read much. I was kind of skeptical because of all of the kind of bad Hollywood superhero movies, which really is a blind spot. I got into graphic novels through graphic memoir, so things like Alison Bechdel's Fun Home and Ethel in Earnest by Raymond Briggs. And more, I think some of it is some graphic novels and some manga. It's just amazing, absolutely amazing kind of experience, it is a very different tradition and a very different way of reading. In a way, it is closer to film, I think. It's a kind of immersive kind of film where you're kind of animating the pictures in your head. But yeah, I love it. And you know, it's I've kind of picked and chosen which ones of theirs that I've read, because I think some of them are, you know, like any form, some of them are better than others.
Yeah. So come on, let's pin you down to some recommendations. You can't do a podcast without top 10 list now. I mean, have you been listening to, that's the point, have you been listening to podcasts as your media forms changed over the last kind of 12 months? I watch very little news now. I get it from my phone and, you know, subscribe to a couple of news sites. But other than that, it's Twitter and podcasts that I'm listening to more rather than watching BBC or CNN a little bit, but you know, only at kind of key points. But I'm not drowning in information as much as I used to.
Yeah. And 24/7 news, the irony on TV, the irony is that you hear less, you know, but there's new wall-to-wall news, and yet there's actually less content than there used to be, because it's just the same stories repeated over and over and over again without any proper kind of analysis. I mean, I listen to podcasts. I've always been a massive fan, I have to say, of Radio Free, you know, which reflects my kind of my general music tastes, which is classical music.
I've got the Amazon Fire Stick, and you can get BBC Sounds on it now. So I just put Through the Night on, because you can listen to it, you know, through BBC Sounds. You can listen to it anytime. No presenters, no news. It's like, oh, wow, it's bliss. I don't need people telling me what's going on and reading out emails and tweets.
Yeah, and Radio Free has always been, but particularly in the last few years, is so eclectic, you know, and so you do come across things that you didn't know. And also, like, you know, it does introduce you to different kinds of music, you know. So yeah, I listen to Radio Free. I mean, I kind of, you know, when it's on, I'm really, my wife listens to Radio 2 a lot, and obviously, you know, other radio stations, but Radio Free. And as you say, sort of iPlayer is so useful because you can kind of catch up, but you can also kind of, if you missed the name of something, you can catch up on the name of that.
Yeah. Any movies? What visual, TV, anything like that? Or have you, you know, you've not taken the plunge into, I mean, I've got so many channels. I've got Disney. I don't know where these have all come from. And maybe I should have a cull. But it's YouTube has been particularly instructive recently, because my partner sitting watches, he wants to go to Japan again. He's been a couple of times before, and he sits there watching people walking around shopping centres and pointing things out, that they're endlessly hours of this stuff. And actually, it's really nice and relaxing, because there's nobody telling you what to think. It's just kind of, oh, look what we've discovered. Oh, wow, you know, YouTube's become this, I think, this you know, if you forget the kind of personality-driven influencer, a YouTuber-type schmaltz that's out there, people are kind of trying to make a quick buck. The ones I like are like, the, you know, it's the slow TV, you know, the barge on a three-hour journey from one place to another along the canal kind of thing, or somebody just out for a walk. I'm getting into that kind of stuff, because you can have it on in the background and read at the same time, or flick through your phone at the same time, have conversations. As you say, it's that kind of multiple things going on at the same time.
I mean, our twins, anything, have watched things like the ones you described, about going around supermarkets in shopping centres in Japan, because they are Japan obsessed, and we will at some point have to kind of, when it's possible, I think, take them. Things like that. I mean, it makes you realise, doesn't it, how directed you are on mainstream TV by voiceovers, by incidental music. You know, any documentary is so kind of directional, so kind of over narrated. I always say, you know, a lot of these things are overproduced, and that they bombard you in a way that they don't give you that time, I think, for thoughtfulness.
I've given up on movies in the first 5 minutes, because they're telling you what's going. You know, it's like you get all of these things kind of. The story is telescoped in the first 5 minutes, And you think, well, what's the point of me watching this? You're telling me already what to expect. There's nothing to discover in the story.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I kind of, it's funny you should mention movies, you know, if we talk about recommendations, that we have, we watch a lot of movies. And my secret pleasure, well, it's not really secret, our secret pleasure is horror movies, you know, that me and my wife, the twins go to bed and they hear this generally incidental music coming up from the living room. But we watch and we have for years, we watch hundreds and hundreds of horror movies. The one time we didn't actually was when the twins were very, very young, because then we couldn't cope with it. As especially any horror movie to do with kids, you just can't, you know, you can't deal with it. But we watch kind of older, what would now be classed as older movies, really. And that I like you, so I honestly think that Hollywood has gone through a really, really bad 20 years, and the movies from Hollywood. We watched It the other day because we thought, well, it's a horror movie, let's see what, you know, contemporary horror movies are like. And it was good, you know, it was good in parts, but there is a kind of as you say, sort of it tells you everything in the first and actually the first 10 minutes of it are the best yeah. part of it, I think.
It could be an age thing. It's like, you know, listening to music and you hear new bands and you go, well, that sounds like this and that sounds like that. You see the, you know, you recognize the tropes and the reference points and things like that. But once you put that aside, I am not a fan of horror movies. You cannot get me to watch a horror movie. Okay. They just freak me out. And particularly during the lockdown, again, my partner, he loves them. So, you know, you'd have a great movie evening with him because you'd be able to. And I think, I don't want this stuff inside my head. The world's horrible enough. I can't cope with it. And looking for something of some light relief is kind of, you know, it's few and far between. My stream on Netflix, it just, for some reason, zombie movies, I cannot understand. I mean, there was a good book I read a few years ago about the phenomena of the zombie, you know, as a metaphor, you know, and it's so prevalent at the, you know, it has been for a few years. And predicting, you know, you can see the rise of the kind of the zombie culture, and it's like, is that just an indication of a kind of deeper rooted sickness? You know, it's like, yeah, I don't want this in my mind. Where's it come from? Yeah. You know, it's like the collective unconscious, you know, bursting out into movies.
Yeah, no, absolutely, that's absolutely right. And I feel the same about the rise of the dystopian movie and also dystopian fiction generally, the Hunger Games, for example, which I really didn't like. It's this kind of phenomenon of looking for dystopias, I think reflects incredibly worryingly actually on our society, because they're not, it's not about the future. They're not about kind of being scared about the future. They're about now. Yeah. They're all of them are about now. And this rare popularity is about seeing a kind of slightly escapist version of what things are like now. And that's really deeply disturbing comment on our society, I think.
Yeah. I mean, I think I mentioned earlier that, you know, kind of a fan of Philip K. Dick and J.G. Ballard for that reason, but they have a particular take on it, which is there's a kind of sense of distance from it, which is about a commentary of where we are now, whereas a lot of the dystopian stuff that gets put out is just you know, it's there for the ride kind of thing. How many thrills can we put in, and how annoying can we be with these, you know, these things that happen, which you go, you just go, this wouldn't happen in real life. But zombies don't happen in real life. Well, maybe it does, I don't know. So,
but it's also, I also think that, I mean, I'd never kind of made the connection, but zombie movies and dystopian movies do have a lot in common. And one of the things I think is, which worries me, is a kind of political defeatism, you know, yeah. But like,
It's like a fatalism, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. God, things are crap. And there's
look, barricade your house and get your guns, you know.
Yeah.
You know, it's aligned with Trumpism. Yeah.
Yeah. In many ways, I think Trumpism and Brexit and so on and so forth, these are actually extremely pessimistic, defeatist agendas, it's really worrying, actually.
It's dare I, my very limited knowledge of Yeats, but everybody knows the second coming. You know, it's there's something turning in the Gaia, and the centre cannot hold, all that kind of stuff. So there's a long tradition of this, I suppose.
Yeah. Did you have you ever seen the it's not Netflix. I can't remember which one it is, but the serial recently, Succession.
No.
Have you come across that? It's fascinating, and in a way, I mean, it's kind of both. It's a kind of mixture of the comic, the realist, and actually, in many ways, dystopian. But it's a kind of fictionalized, very, very heavily fictionalized version of the Murdoch family. And so it's about sort of this media billionaire family, and it's incredibly disturbing, some of it, you know. So it's all about.
I've just got it up on the internet, and it's the one with Brian Cox in.
Is that right? Yeah,
I think so. Yeah.
I don't know. I never know actors. I can never remember actors' names apart from Cary Grant. It was so painful to watch. It was there were one or two episodes where I was hovering over the off button. It was true horror, and the reason it was horror was because you thought, oh my goodness me, this is probably true.
The last time I had a moment like that was with His Dark Materials, when they were doing the kind of heist episode. I don't know if you saw it, but that had that moment. I had to fast forward because it was so tense and engrossing. It was like, oh, okay, I will check this out. It's 21 episodes.
It was brilliant. It was brilliant, but it was kind of the absolute opposite to the world that I live in, but also the world that I want to live in.
Well, I've been scooting around looking on Wikipedia, and I found the word that I was looking for is antinom. I can't even pronounce it. Antinomy, which is like a zebra's stripes. It's antinomic. You've got the black and the white, and it's the paradox and the contradiction are kind of held. It's an apparent contradiction, but it's part of the same. And that kind of sense of what you're seeing on the one hand is this power, but you're seeing on the other hand this kind of complete. And we've seen this in Trump, haven't we? This kind of complete meltdown of order and sense, and gosh, we could talk about this for hours. So anything, anything. What's the best way for people to get in contact with you? I don't want to take up more of your time because we could talk for another couple of hours, I imagine. But if somebody wants to get in touch with you, what's the best way for them to do that? You're on Twitter.
I'm on Twitter at CrystalClearJT, and they can also find me via my website. My email's on my website, and it's also on my university page. So, I'd love to hear from people.
Brilliant.
And I also run a couple of blogs. One's called, if you just type into Google, Everybody's Reviewing, which is a book review blog. So,
I will put links to all of this in the I think what is termed by podcasters the show notes, but since it's not a show, it might have some notes, but it's not show notes anyway. But I'll put some links to it. Jonathan's been amazing. Thank you very much for giving up your time. If you want to contact me, I'm on robwatsonmedia.net and Twitter and Instagram at robwmedia. But until next time, thanks very much. You've been listening to the Distraction Therapy Podcast with me, Rob Watson. If you want to get in contact, I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Rob W. Media, or visit the website robwatsonmedia.net.